Please call the case. Good morning, Ms. Hironaka and Mr. Anderson. Are you both ready to proceed today? All right. The court has scheduled this case for a total of 40 minutes, so 20 minutes aside. Ms. Hironaka will give you a warning when we get to 3 minutes, so you can save that time for rebuttal, and we'll give you a two-minute warning. Mr. Anderson, thank you. Please proceed, Ms. Hironaka.
May it please the court, Raymond S. Davis respectfully requests that this honorable court, number one, reverse the ICA's approval of the district court's admission of state's exhibits numbers 1 and 2 for two reasons. Number one, for lack of evidentiary foundation, and number two, for violation of the Hawaii Confrontation Clause, Article 1, Section 14. That in turn requires that this court reconsider and overrule the holding in Marshall that ISSs, which is intoxicizer supervisor's sworn statements, are considered non-testimonial or deemed non-testimonial, and the rulings in Fitzwater, three. One is that the admission of the speed check or an ISSS is not a violation of Sixth Amendment or Article 1, Section 14. Two, that the speed check card or an ISSS is non-testimonial, but for Fitzwater, it's the speed check card. And three, evidentiary matter, that the speed check card or the ISSS would be admissible as a business record even though it was created for the purpose of prosecuting speeding cases. And finally, since the ICA relied in this case on the State versus Sunny West, which was an SDO, we ask that it overrule Part D only because they based it on Marshall and Fitzwater.
Ms. Hironaka, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but with respect to your point about the sworn statements, and looking at the appendix D and E, I wanted to ask you about the extent to which the language in the sworn statement is relevant to your argument or not. In other words, if you want to take a moment and get that sworn statement, do you have it there in front of you? This is... Yes, I believe so.
You're talking about...
But anyways, it's the police department sworn statement of Officer Kang.
Okay.
I'm sure you have that there. Those two sworn statements that you were referring to.
Yes.
One is March 16th and one is February 29th. And there is language in the sworn statement that reads as follows. The intoxilizer was operating accurately. Now, how is that relevant to your argument or not? In other words, does that affect the extent to which it's admissible, for example, as a business record?
I'm sorry, can you restate?
There is a statement, presumably by Officer Kang, in this exhibit, the sworn statement. If you look at the final paragraph, which is his sworn statement, in the last sentence, it says the intoxilizer was operating accurately.
Yes.
To what extent is that relevant to your position that this wouldn't be admissible as a business record?
Would not be. Because any of the statements in here are testimonial, number one. And
are they equally as testimonial? That's what I'm trying to understand. Is this something that could be characterized differently than the rest of this sworn statement? Does it have more of a testimonial nature to it?
Equally as testimonial? I believe that all the statements that Mr. Kang wrote in there are testimonial. He stated that the printout is true and correct. He stated that he's a licensed intox supervisor. He's trained to maintain the intox. He's trained to perform accuracy tests. That the intox is approved breath testing instrument, that it was operating accurately on the test date, and that it was operating in compliance with HAR 11-114-7.
Well, there are many observations in the statement, but it would seem that the public records exception anticipates observations that are merely recording something that has seen as a, has been seen, as opposed to reaching a conclusion about it. So that's the reason I was focusing on that. It would seem that it stands out much like a business record. I suppose you could think of a business record, for example, from a telephone company, where the affidavit of the custodian of records says these are the records and this is the nature of the conversations that have been taking place. That would be more of a narrative and a personal judgment. So I'm, but that's the reason I drew your attention to it, to see the extent to which it might be relevant to being a business record, that if that's a conclusion.
My response to that, first of all, is
Ms. Hironaka, could you speak into the mic so we can get a good recording?
My response to that is that the police business records are categorically different from the Palmer v. Hoffman or the telephone company's type of business records, because in this case, it's the police are in the business of prosecuting DUI cases or criminal cases in general.
If could you just square that with the footnote in Melendez-Diaz that said, where, you know, the majority, or Justice Scalia, was responding to concerns expressed by the dissent about the sweep of the majority's opinion, and he observed that, additionally, documents prepared in the regular course of equipment maintenance may well qualify as non-testimonial records, and also said testimony about the accuracy of a testing device may not necessarily be subject or may be non-testimonial. So how is it that you square your position that I think everything that a police department does is testimonial with those comments in that footnote, or at least everything a police department does in this context?
Right. Those comments, I would submit, are suggestive in the manner of dicta. I don't think it's, for lack of a more eloquent way of saying it, that the court was sort of thinking off the top of its head that certain documents may be business records. Going back to that situation that I pointed out about, say, Palmer versus Hoffman, that's the railroad's business, okay? And the railroad was in the business of railroading, so its records would be business records without a problem because they're not in the business of prosecuting, whereas I see a difference with the police department's records being, in this case, you know, he tested it specifically to prosecute somebody for a DUI case.
But at the time he tested it, there was no particular prosecution of this individual contemplated. In fact, I think the arrest hadn't even occurred yet.
Right. No, and I understand that. But I again submit, or Davis again submits, that that's a distinction without a difference, because the fact is that the only reason that Mr. Kang was checking the accuracy of the intoxes was for all, you know, unknown DUI defendants that are going to be tested within the next month or so. And so, although they can't put a name on the guy in particular, I submit to you that that's not a distinction that's of any moment.
Mr. Hironaka, what about testing this accuracy of speedometers of police officers' cars?
Same thing, Your Honor, because it's the only reason that cars are police vehicles have their speedometers tested is so that they can know that their speedometers are operating accurately, so that when they pull somebody over who's going 70 miles an hour and they're looking at their speedometer that says 70 miles an hour, that they can, you know, pretty much prove that the guy was going 70 miles an hour.
Isn't that part of the regular maintenance of a car?
No, Your Honor. And the reason that I disagree with you on that is that the only vehicles that I know of that have to undergo this calibration check are police vehicles. If it were relevant to the safety of a vehicle, all of us who own vehicles would have to have that checked as part of their annual safety check. And the fact that it's not required seems to me that it's only for police vehicles. Then the reason is because they prosecute people for
speeding. So then would there need to be live testimony from everyone who's involved at all in this testing or calibration procedure? In fact, maybe even beyond Mr. Kang, if there were folks who set up the samples, for example, and those samples wouldn't be set up but for the fact that the police department needed to calibrate this device. Would those individuals have to come in? Anyone who's at all affiliated with the police department's calibration of its equipment?
I am really not prepared to answer that question because my focus was on the Officer Kang, the intoxilizer supervisor, and his testing device. And if I may, although it's not on the record, Mr. Anderson, I'm sure can remember these things, is that when we were new deputies in district court back in the early 90s for me, they always did bring the intox supervisor down. So the clear key material witnesses were the arresting officer, which they called the AO, the intoxilizer operator, which is the person who did the breath test, and the IS, which was the intoxilizer supervisor. And somewhere along the way, they've shortened the process where the IS does not need to come back.
Well, Ms. Hironaka, in terms of, I'm sorry, did you finish?
I am, thank you.
Okay. The Hawaii administrative rule that's been passed that explains in some detail the procedures that are meant, I think, to ensure reliability of
yes.
the intoxilizer test
yes.
serve some purpose. I mean, to what extent in your analysis can the government rely upon compliance with this administrative rule in order to provide a foundation for the admissibility of the results of an intoxilizer test?
I still believe that there's a violation of the confrontation clause on that, and I'm looking at subchapter 1 of Title 11-114, specifically section 1, paren B, where it says that this chapter applies, basically it's for the purpose of introduction of the alcohol test results into evidence in criminal proceedings under applicable state driving under the influence of alcohol statute. So it's pretty clear that it's the whole purpose of this title is for prosecution of DUI cases. And so the fact that, you know, the intox operator, the intox supervisor have to comply with these rather technical requirements laid out in there is to make their proof fail-proof or fail-safe.
Well, and just to be clear then, you're proposing a procedure by which the supervisor testifies about how this administrative rule, Title 11, Chapter 114, is complied with. Is that the way you see the use of this chapter?
Again, I'm sorry. I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, I'm reaching for how you think this administrative rule is going to be used. I mean, would you agree that it would form the basis of the testimony of the supervisor when he appears in court?
Oh, certainly. Certainly. But the testimony of the supervisor, presuming he says, you know, I checked the solution, you know, I in testing the instrument, I followed the rules of 114-7 by first doing an air blank and then doing a simulator solution which had, you know, was supposed to be 0.10 and it turned out to be 0.10 and then I did, you know, the air blanked it out and I tried a second simulator solution. Those show the reliability of the instrument. So I would have no doubt that he'd be testifying according to what is listed in here, because those are the foundational requirements that show that particular intox was operating properly on the day in question.
Are there any references to the reference samples in the sworn statements of Officer Kang?
No, and that's the problem. That was my initial problem, which actually was not constitutional, but it was just the basic problem is that the reason that those two documents were irrelevant is because they didn't tie up or link up why the instrument was working properly. So, for example, if you have a sample solution that it's 0.10 of alcohol content and you run it, then the machine should show somewhere close to 0.10 if you want to say that the machine is working properly. But in this case, they just ran it and they said, here's the results, but we don't know what the target values for.
Well, now ACA relied on the fact that the statement says the intoxilizer was operating accurately in compliance with the administrative rules. Now, why, in your view, is that not a sufficient foundation?
Because it's a completely testimonial statement by Officer Kang. We don't have the opportunity to cross-examine him as to what he did to come up with that conclusion that it was operating properly on that.
But that goes to confrontation clause, not mm-hmm. to foundation.
Right, but even as to.
So you're. I thought we were arguing about the foundation issue right now, that you
right.
said there was a lack of foundation. So the ICA, if I understood, said, well, there was in their view, there was foundation because of the statement in the declaration that the intoxilizer was operating accurately in compliance with the administrative rules. I take it you disagree. Could you explain why?
And with all due respect, the ICA didn't even address the lack of, the target values in the two exhibits or anywhere in the evidence. They completely overlooked that, in my opinion. And they went, and part of it, I think, is that they started with the 803B8 and 9024 analysis instead of considering the confrontation clause issue. Because under either version, regardless whether the ISSs are testimonial or non-testimonial, if they're testimonial, obviously you have to go through Crawford, you have to show unavailability of the witness, and then you have to show prior opportunity to cross. If they are non-testimonial, then you, under the Hawaii Constitution, you have to follow the Fields-Roberts test, which would be that you still have to show unavailability, and then you have to show that it's there's indicia of reliability. So under either test, regardless of whether the document is non-testimonial or testimonial, you have to show the unavailability, which is the initial thing that was not met.
Let me just make answer your question. I think what Chief Justice is asking you is, you're saying that, are you suggesting that the court should have gone to a confrontation analysis before a hearsay analysis or a relevancy analysis?
I guess that's how I was looking at it, because that's how that's the only way I can figure that they missed Mr. Davis's confrontation argument. Entirely.
But why would a court go to a constitutional confrontation analysis if there's a hearsay issue? I mean, Justice Wilson was asking questions along that line. If it doesn't fit the exception, or if it's irrelevant because it doesn't cite to a reference sample, then why are we talking confrontation?
In raising his appeal, I had to raise every issue that I could see.
Was there an observation here under 803B8? In other words, the hearsay exception under 803B8 is matters observed pursuant to duty imposed by law. The statement that the intoxilizer was operating properly, was that an observation?
By Officer King?
Yes.
Yes.
How?
It requires actually his expertise, if you will, as an intoxilizer supervisor, which means that he did his testing, and in his opinion, it was operating correctly.
Isn't that an expert opinion, not an observation?
Right. You're correct.
So does this actually meet the 803B8 hearsay exception?
Perhaps it does not.
So do we need to go any further?
Perhaps this court does not. I mean, there are a number of things that I see wrong with the admission of that document in the Davis case. And so there are a number of ways that this court can resolve, the appellate issue here. And so that's, of course, up to this court's, wisdom.
Do you want to reserve your time for rebuttal or anything else that you wanted to cover at this point?
Well, gosh. Everything here. I wanted to. Let me reserve, and then I will respond to Mr.
Thank you very much, Mr. Anderson.
Good morning, Jim Anderson from the state. We are required to show strict compliance with Title 11. The way you do that is to show that the intoxilizer is in proper working order. You do that by showing the two accuracy tests. Which is under 114-7 pursuant to that, and the test record when the test is actually administered. We show that the operator was qualified. We usually have the testimony there that the officer testified he did his training under the chief of police or his representative and did the minimum hours. And then we also use judicial notice that the training program was approved by the DUI coordinator.
And putting aside the administrative rule requirements, could you address the issue of whether or not this is an 803B8 observation?
I think it is more under 803B6.
Business record.
A business, yes.
Okay. All right. Do you concede, do you concede that State versus Fields under our Constitution requires a showing of unavailability?
Absolutely not. I think it's an opposite, actually. And I think it is non-testimonial. And
Fields does not distinguish, correct?
Pardon me?
Fields does not require testimonial. So you, even if it is non-testimonial under Fields, you still have to show unavailability,
Fields,
correct?
Fields to me states that you have adhered to the Roberts test, and that under our Constitution, our Confrontation Clause, that you have to show unavailability and the indicia of reliability through two different ways, firmly rooted hearsay or through totality of the circumstances. I think these are preliminary matters of fact under 104C and 1101D1. And I think these are matters that go to the admissibility of evidence. They take it out of field.
Was there a showing of unavailability in this case?
No, I don't think you need to do it, because I think they're preliminary matters to which the rules of hearsay do not apply. 104C says that. 1101D1 says that, Your Honor.
So this is actually a constitutional analysis, right? Fairness to the defendant.
I don't know why. All right. Yes, I like that. I'm glad you brought that up, because, as you said, Justice Nakayama, in footnote 9 of Fields, there has to be a reason to it. You, of course, you can do it. You can extend, you know, protection under the Hawaii Constitution. But you can't do it just because you can. You should do it if you should. And there's no reason here to do that. The United States Confrontation Clause protects you adequately, protects our citizens adequately here. We don't need further protection here. That's my response to that. So you get all the protection you need already.
So you're arguing that the Hawaii Confrontation Clause shouldn't be applied?
No, I'm not saying that, Your Honor. I'm sorry if I caused that misunderstanding. I'm saying you don't need to go further if the United States Constitution adequately protects our interests.
But we've adopted Fields, and we had, I think it was NAFOA, just this past year again, reaffirming Fields. It says you do the Crawford analysis under the federal Constitution and the Roberts analysis under the Hawaii Constitution.
And that's fine. If that's where we are then I would still maintain that the rules of hearsay don't apply, and these are preliminary matters, so I don't think that the Confrontation Clause is a trial right.
Okay.
Not preliminary matters to admissibility of the evidence like foundation. Those are reserved to the court, I believe.
Okay. You're not suggesting that the hearsay rule didn't apply to this declaration?
No.
I just want to clarify. You said you didn't really think this was a public record exception. You think this comes in under a business record exception.
Yeah, I don't even know if they call it business.
It's called a...
Records of regularly conducted activity.
Right. Okay. And so this is not a public record. It doesn't qualify.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so.
Doesn't qualify, or you think there are alternate ways of getting it in?
That could be true. You know, I haven't really worked on that, Your Honor, to tell you the truth. Yeah.
But your reliance here is...
But I always went with B6. So. But are there any other concerns? Because, I'd like to go through...
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, well, there are two challenges brought here are that there are no target values of the reference samples in the accuracy test results. We used to call it 30-30. You test on either side of the ref test, actual ref test. And I think you can arithmetically, you have the result here from the reference sample. So you can look at the rule, which is Title 11, 114-7, 3, 4, and 5, to determine exactly what the parameters of the reference sample was. So it has to, target values must be no less than 0.4 grams of alcohol per 200 liters and no more than 0.25. They shall differ from each other by 0.4. And if he attests, the supervisor attests, that he performed the accuracy test according to 1147 and it was accurate, then they fall right here. So you can arithmetically figure that out.
So, Mr. Anderson, we're to assume that the, by virtue of having been trained and qualified, Officer Tang, as the intoxilizer supervisor, we're supposed to assume that he understands the requirements of the administrative rules and has complied specifically with those provisions of the statute that lay out what the sample is supposed to
be,
the sample test.
Absolutely. And all we are need, all we need to do, this is not like a manufacturer's, the courts here have never relied upon manufacturer's recommendations. It's strict compliance with Title 11. Title 11 says do this, and he did it according to 1147. And if you want to know, and this is what it says that he's supposed to do.
Why have then the recitation that's in his sworn statement? There, as you can see, there is a listing of the results of the tests that were performed by Officer Kang, correct?
Absolutely.
Why have that? Why not just have Officer Kang say, pursuant to the duly established qualifications, I have run the test, and the test complies with the administrative rules, period.
I think that would be sufficient as well. But this also shows that the machine was operating properly. You know, you have the air blank zeroing out, you have the reference sample, and then you have other air blanks and the right temperature. So, you know, he's being a little more, giving more information. He's probably showing the printout of the machine. That's what it is, in fact.
Well, it's an interesting question. Where is the defendant's right to, I guess, confront this evidence, which is the core evidence against him, I guess, the intoxilizer results. And in this case, you have Officer Kang also talking about how the intoxilizer was operating properly. I mean, how far can he go in his affidavit? Could he go beyond that and say that this is a test that it indicates that the intoxilizer that's been operating accurately duly establishes establishes a level of blood intoxication beyond the legal limit? You wouldn't be able to do that, right?
My response to you is he's done what is required under Title 11. He said so. You have a problem with the specifics? You subpoena him. I mean, you get him in court. We don't have to. We met our burden. We set our prima facie case. We have shown strict compliance with Title 11.
But I guess the argument is he's gone beyond Title 11 and has given an opinion about the fact that the machine is operating properly. I don't know how that.
Your Honor, he's required by law to ensure the accuracy of the blood breath testing instrument. And so he after performing his test, then he writes whether it's operating accurately or not.
That takes some expertise, right? I don't think I could just walk over to the machine and just run a sample.
I don't know, Your Honor. It doesn't seem like it's very complicated. It seems like you put in the test card and you push a button.
But doesn't it say that he's a duly licensed supervisor trained to maintain and perform accuracy tests? I mean,
yeah.
Okay, so he has a certain level of expertise, and he's using his expertise apparently with the result of these samples, some of them which aren't listed, to come up with a result that says this thing was accurately working.
Well, all his qualifications are that he's either been trained by the chief of police for 8 hours or representative, and that he has 1 year experience in the operation, care, and maintenance of the intoxilizer. So I don't know how complicated that is, Your Honor. I think it's very basic. You have a reference sample, a target value, you put it in the machine, it reads out, and if it falls within the parameters in 114-E, 7E, then it's working accurately. Yeah. Right. Oh, I'd like to point out, Your Honor, the machines aren't calibrated. They're already calibrated. That's why we put in that certificate initially, showing that it is initially calibrated by the manufacturer, CMI. What we're talking about is accuracy tests or tests, accuracy tests, you know, in the 30-30 test, every other month test, and or the one conducted during the breath test itself. But, all right, to judicial notice.
What
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry. Please go ahead.
No, I was just wondering about...
Is that a distinction without a difference?
Pardon me?
Is that a distinction without a difference? It's not calibrated. We're just testing it for accuracy.
People use those words interchangeably, Your Honor. But I think calibrating is setting the instrument up the way it's supposed to operate initially by the manufacturer. Then you perform accuracy tests to make sure it's still in good working order. That's the way I've seen it. I started with a beam attenuator in 1988,
right.
And now I'm here again. But it's been the same story all along, you know.
Is it your position that this document, the intoxilizer supervisor sworn statement, is testimonial or not?
Non-testimonial.
And why is that?
Because it's a regularly conducted business activity required by law. To keep the...
Why isn't the, again, Ms. Hiranaka's argument that within the meaning of Melendez-Diaz, this would be a testimonial document. It's something that was, in essence, prepared for and with the purpose of a prosecution. So this is like the drug analyst affidavits or declarations in Melendez-Diaz.
Not even close, Your Honor. I think the main purpose of this is to ensure the accuracy, as the evidence says. The purpose of this chapter is to ensure that appropriate and uniform forensic alcohol testing is performed throughout the state of Hawaii. That is the primary purpose. The fact that it has a collateral purpose doesn't take away from that, and is certainly not specific to Davis at all. So there's no way, to me, that this is testimonial.
I suppose your view would be the same if the prosecution waited until there was actually a charge before testing the machine. In this case, the timing is such that the police department regularly tests the machines pursuant to the administrative regulations, and we have a couple of examples of that that took place prior to this case. But if the police department waited until there's actually a charge before conducting these tests to establish the accuracy of the machine, your position would probably still be the same, that... Well, the police department doesn't have to conduct these tests prior to a case being brought. I mean,
it does, Your Honor. It has to conduct a test on either side of the actual breath test.
Sure, but if it turns, but if it turns out that within that, if you will, within that frame of time that's required under the administrative rules, they could perform a test, say the second test in relation to the charge, then they would be performing the same type of administrative work. It would just be in relation to the charge itself, if you follow me. Well, you can see that they test periodically.
Definitely, every 31 days.
Right? Right, so if they decide one of the tests is going to be conducted
earlier or later?
Well, I assume that they'll have a test that precedes the date of arrest, but if the date of arrest is within the 31 days, and they can go ahead and do this particular test in a time frame that's very close in time to the case involved, right?
I don't think that changes the primary purpose of it, though. Yeah.
Every 31 days?
I think so. I think we used to call it the 30-30. But, you know, I thought it was every 31 days, but I'm not sure. I'll stand corrected on that. But is there any issue with this court as to judicial notice of these four documents, the calibration certificate, that the intoxilizer 8000 was approved by the DUI coordinator, that the accuracy verification device was approved, because he's supposed to, any modifications of instruments, accessories, or accuracy verification devices under 5C, he's supposed to send out letters. And CB World has said that only testing procedures approved in writing shall be used, so, you know, with respect to new things. So I think these are properly taken judicial notice of because we have the DOH letterhead. It's capable of accurate and ready determination by resort to sources who can't be reasonably questioned. We have Dr. Wynn's name, his title, his signature, his phone number, the DOH letterhead, and it's under seal. And at the bottom it says, these copies can be are on file at the Department of Health. I don't know about the 11th floor of the district court building. I don't know anything, I've never been up there. But they are, the document itself says they're on file at the Department of Health. So you should be able to go and get them. You might have to pay a fee for a public record. But
Mr. Anderson, so the machines are only tested for accuracy once a month, basically?
Well, here it looks like, yeah, I think so. I think every 31 days. Something in my head tells me every 31 days. But, because this one was 216 and the other one was 229. Well, maybe not. Yeah, looks like more here. So maybe, I'm not sure. I'm sure that we probably use the one closest to, you know, the rec test to show that it's indeed accurate. So I have nothing else. If you folks have nothing.
Yes, I would. What I would ask you to do, Mr. Anderson, is please come back to this question of the statement in the supervisor's sworn statement that the intoxilizer was operating accurately in compliance with the rules. Is that the kind of sort of recording of sort of day-to-day information or data that is contemplated by the Hawaii Rules of Evidence, or is that more of a statement of a conclusion and an analysis which goes beyond what one might expect to properly come in under either 80B6 or 80B8, I'm sorry, 803B6 or B8?
I think it comes in as regularly conducted activity concerning the accuracy of the breath testing instrument.
So that's under B6, correct?
So.
How about under B8, where there's a provision A that talks about the activities of the officer agency? Could it come in under that?
I would think it could as well, just from what you're saying.
Did you argue 803B6 below? I thought it was only 803B8 that
I forget.
I mean the state.
Yeah, I forget. But I did say it was a business record. Now, and none of these rules actually say business record. But I think I've usually relied upon B6. I have it tabbed here, in fact. Is B6 and not B8 on the other side of the rules. So, you know.
Well, your answering brief refers to B8. That's
okay,
why I'm asking.
Then I was wrong there, I think. Well, but it can come in either way.
But essentially, your concern would be if you're trying to argue under the public record doctrine, then you would naturally have a concern that we have an expert opinion that is included in this document.
Okay.
What would your answer be? So if we're under B8, B8 talks about matters observed pursuant to a duty. Is this an observation within the meaning of that portion of the rule? Matters observed pursuant to a duty. In other words, test results are matters, they're facts and the like, but the statement that the intoxilizer was operating accurately, is that an observation made pursuant to a duty?
I guess it is, sure. I would.
Well, I guess the question is it an observation?
No, I think it's a fact, deduced from other facts.
So you think it is within the scope of being an observation then, because it's based on other factual observations?
So what hearsay objection applies to that statement?
Pardon me?
So what hearsay exception? So that would be hearsay within hearsay, right? Because the document might be a business record under 803B6. The observations as to the test results might qualify under 803B8. But the statement that the device was working properly, what hearsay, because you have different levels of hearsay now, so this is hearsay within hearsay, what hearsay exception applies to that statement?
Yeah, I don't know. I always thought it just came in under as a business record because it was regularly conducted activity. I didn't break it down that way. I don't know if I can answer that. Obviously not.
Anything further, Mr. Anderson?
No, I'm done.
All right. Ms. Hiranaka, your rebuttal.
I wanted to return to Justice McKenna's question about whether it was under 803D. 6 or B8, and your question had to do with under B8. And in rereading B8, I don't believe that document would be admissible under B8 because although it says public records and reports, it says that excluding, however, criminal matters observed in criminal cases, matters observed by police officers and other law enforcement personnel. So I believe that it's saying public records and reports. I mean, it understands that the police are in the business of prosecuting cases, and so they're not neutral witnesses, versus a public record of, like, say, the state library or someplace like that, where their records are not made in the business of prosecuting cases. Therefore,
so anything the police does, even though there's no case pending at that time, any testing that they do of their equipment cannot come in under B8B? Is that your position?
That is my position.
What about 8A, the activities of the officer agency? Why would that not provide a basis for admission of the report of the ISSS?
Because again, the distinction between the police, which are in the business of prosecuting, versus in a regular railroad business, or like state library or whatever it is, that they're not in the business of manufacturing evidence, but making evidence for subsequent prosecution. I think that is a very big distinction.
Well, assuming the observations but not the expert opinion, which there seems to be two types of information on this report.
Correct.
If I recall correctly, the argument today here has been that, well, this will come in as a business record. If I believe that if a record is excluded under the public record exception, because of the fact that records can fall into both categories, mm-hmm. and the real concern with the drafters of the evidence code, that you could basically eliminate the exclusion in 8 by eliminating the exclusion in the public record by allowing it under the business record. If in fact a record is excluded under the public record exception, it's not allowed to be admitted in the business record exception, if in fact it's a police observation you're talking about.
I understand your concern. I agree with your concern.
That's not my concern. I'm just saying I believe that's the
it should
evidence.
Be able to be backdoored, basically.
Yes, you cannot swallow one, the public record exception, by just sneaking in it, basically, into the business record exception.
Agreed, Your Honor.
Why wouldn't it be the activities of the officer agency, and the exclusion doesn't apply, at least on its face, to A. So 8A says records, reports, statements, or data compilations in any form of public offices or agencies setting forth the activities of the office or agency. Why would that not apply here?
Because the reason that Mr. Kang is doing what he's doing is for the prosecution of DUI cases. He has a bent, or he has an agenda, if you will. It's meant for prosecution, as opposed to just your standard, mom
but
and pop.
B addresses that because it has the excluding in criminal cases language. A, that exclusion doesn't appear in A.
You're correct. However, I still believe that overall, basically, things that are observed by police in prosecution of certain cases, or in prosecution of cases, that should not be admissible under B8.
Anything further to wrap up?
Well, first, I just wanted to comment, which is that the second judicial notice issue, which was in my brief, I did not cert that, and so that was not at, should not be at issue before this court. With respect to, I think it was Justice Wilson's question about assuming that Officer Kang did what he was supposed to do, that's the whole problem that we have here, which is that you can't assume that he properly, did his tests, etc. he could be shortcutting. I mean, there's many instances where laboratories have, you know, faked evidence or otherwise. I'm not saying that Officer Kang may have, but part of the truth-seeking function is to be able to question somebody about what their work was, what they did, et cetera, to ensure that they properly tested the machine or did whatever it was that they were supposed to do, and that's the opportunity that was missing for Mr. Davis. And then finally, I think this was in regards to the Chief Justice's questions. Basically, the whole purpose of Title 11 is for that prosecution of DUI cases. So by following them, I mean, the state is doing that for a reason. It's, even though you might term the document, I'm going back to confrontation now, non-testimonial, et cetera, the whole purpose of following up with, you know, and being careful about making sure you comply with Title 11 is to make sure that you have a basis to say, my evidence is valid. My breath result that I obtained was a valid result and therefore reliable. But again, we do ask this court to reverse Mr. Davis's conviction and then also to reconsider the Marshall holding as well as the related holdings in Fitzwater.
Thank you very much to both of our attorneys today. The court will take this matter under advisement.